smallest in the world, was one of the three churches that were damaged across the strip. In addition to churches, at least 114 mosques have been destroyed and 200 others have been damaged in Gaza, including the 13th century Othman bin Qashqar Mosque in Al-Zaytun neighborhood, south of Gaza City, and the medieval Great Omari Mosque, the largest and oldest mosque in Gaza, located in the heart of the old town east of Gaza City and dating back to the 7th century. Ahmad As-Saqa, 64, who lives in Ash-Shujaiya neighborhood, a few kilometers away from the Omari Mosque, said that she has prayed in the mosque since she was a child, especially during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Currently displaced in the Deir al-Balah in the central Gaza Strip after her house was severely damaged, Saqa said she was more saddened by the destruction of the mosque than of her own home. Saqa told Middle East Eye, "I was born and have lived all my life in this neighborhood. When I was around 6 years old and throughout all my childhood years, my father used to take me and my siblings every night during Ramadan to perform the Taraweeh prayers in this mosque. I had my childhood and adulthood memories there. For us Palestinians, it is more than just a mosque. It is our history and our present. When we talk about Gaza, we talk about the Omari Mosque. We believe that it would be impossible to harm such a place, not just because it was a holy site, but because of its rich history and importance for both Muslims and Christians around the world. The mosque, which was converted from a Byzantine church, is considered one of the oldest in the world. Close to the Omari Mosque lies Hammam al-Samra, a prominent and rare surviving example of an Ottoman architectural site in Gaza. On December 30, the Zionist regime's strikes directly hit the site, destroying Turkish-style features that date back to over 1,000 years. In a report released by Heritage for Peace in November documenting the impact of the Zionist regime's war on Gaza's cultural heritage, the organization said at least 104 out of 195 architectural heritage sites that it counted in the coastal enclave were destroyed or damaged. Since it is impossible to assess the damage on site, the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, experts say they have been remotely monitoring the situation using satellite data and information transmitted to us by third parties, in coordination with its partners and UN agencies on the ground and our office in Ramallah. A UNESCO spokesperson told Middle East Eye, requesting anonymity, UNESCO has initiated early October remote monitoring of the damage. As part of this remote monitoring, we are particularly concerned about the situation of the ruins of St. Hilarison, inscribed on the National Tentative List of World Heritage in 2012. These are the remains of one of the region's earliest Christian monasteries. The ruins of St. Hilarison are part of the Tell Amr site located in An-Nusayrat camp in the central Gaza Strip. The site has been severely damaged by the Zionist regime's campaign. The conflict in the Gaza Strip has caused a serious humanitarian crisis affecting all aspects of civilian life. As stated publicly on several occasions, UNESCO is gravely concerned about this impact on education, culture, and protection of journalists, the pillars of its mandate, he said. While humanitarian emergencies are a legitimate priority, the protection of cultural heritage in all its forms, as well as the protection of educational and media infrastructures, must also be ensured In accordance with international law, which stipulates that cultural property is civilian infrastructure and as such must neither be targeted nor used for military purposes, he said. Another notable casualty of airstrikes in the Gaza City was the Central Archive building, which was destroyed on November 29th. Run by the municipality of Gaza, the building contained thousands of historical documents and national records about Gaza dating back over 100 years. In addition, at least three museums were destroyed or severely damaged, including government-run Pasha Palace Museum, which dates back to the 13th century and was directly targeted. Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. As the Zionist entity continues waging its campaign of terror and genocide against the people of Palestine, there are many who make the mistake of thinking that only the Muslims of Palestine face the tyranny of the Zionist regime. On this week's show, we look at the plight faced by the Christians of Palestine at the hands of both the Zionist state and the extremist Jewish settlers living on stolen Palestinian land. And we begin by analysing exactly why Palestine and Jerusalem in particular are so important to adherents of the Christian religion.
December is the time of year that Christians worldwide celebrate the birth of the Messiah, Jesus, may peace and blessings be upon him. Celebrations in Bethlehem, the birthplace of Jesus, are considered holy because the passion and resurrection of Jesus happened inside the city's walls. Bethlehem is a Palestinian city in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, surrounded today by a massive concrete wall, military checkpoints, and illegal settlements.
It's imposing a system of control that I'm sure Jesus was very familiar of. If he's born today, he would be born on our side of the wall.
According to the Gospels, the most important features of Christianity have their origins in Jerusalem. The institution of the Eucharist took place while Jesus was celebrating Passover with his disciples in Jerusalem. Also, his crucifixion at the Golgotha, where Jesus remained calm, compassionate, and loving even in the face of death. And according to Christian belief, his resurrection 3 days later all happened in Jerusalem. In this way, Jerusalem constitutes a unique and holy city for Christianity. Other holy sites are associated with events from the Old Testament, the lives of Mary, John the Baptist, and the Apostles, with endless more associated with later Christian saints, holy men and women, and local traditions. But Bethlehem will be a somber place this year, as the Christian of the three major churches, Greek Orthodox, Armenian, and Catholic, have stated they will not be celebrating.
This year is going to be totally different. There won't be any lights. We will not have the Christmas tree. We will be mourning those who are being slaughtered in Gaza. There's a deep atmosphere of grief here, and all the churches have decided to only have religious services for Christmas.
These holy places, the indigenous Christian community and pilgrims who come to visit from all over the world, have long been the subject of violence, harassment, and intimidation by the occupation forces who have not allowed the community to worship in peace. The Temple Mount is no exception, often the subject of brutality despite being considered a holy place. It is where Jesus was first presented as an infant to the temple and its people by his holy mother Maryam. It was also there where he famously taught elders of the community at the tender age of 13 and later threw out the money changers from the same temple grounds. Unfortunately, the percentage of Christians living in Bethlehem and in other occupied Palestinian territories has plummeted. With the community currently totaling under 2% of the population, the fear that Christians will one day no longer have a presence in Palestine is slowly becoming a reality. The reason is extremely clear for the indigenous worshippers.
Joining us on the show this week to discuss this important topic are two special guests. Joining us in the studio is Amira Aqil, who is a board member of Palestine Pulse, a London-based group on the path to creating a new movement led by the grandchildren of the Nakba and like-minded peers, amplifying the Palestinian liberation movement through British-based voices. And we are also extremely honoured to be joined by Reverend Dr. Stephen Sizer, the founder and director of Peacemaker Trust, a UK charity dedicated to peacemaking, especially where minorities are persecuted and where human rights are suppressed. Reverend Dr. Stephen is also the director of the Institute of the Study of Christian Zionism and a member of the executive of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. He is a retired Anglican priest, but continues to serve as chaplain to the former Bishop of Jerusalem, Bishop Riyah Abul Asal. Reverend, if I can come to you, please, first. Thank you again for joining us. Why do Christians have such an affinity with Palestine and Jerusalem?
We have a strong affinity for Palestine in particular because it's the location of where God's redemptive plan was achieved in and through the Lord Jesus. He was born in Bethlehem. He lived much of his life in the Galilee, and he was arrested, crucified, and rose again in Jerusalem. So the central tenets of the historic life and teaching of Jesus revolve around Palestine. And not surprisingly, it was where the church was founded among his followers. And so the Palestinian Christian community represents the indigenous mother church, if you like, for the global church today.
Thank you for that. I know it seemed like such an obvious question, but, you know, I feel like the Christian community often don't speak enough about the relevance of Palestine. And Amira, yourself, who has lived as a Palestinian, lived in her homeland and have been given the privilege of traveling extensively because you are British, obviously it's a privilege that other Palestinians don't have. Let me ask you about what you've seen in your time in Palestine, about the oppression of the indigenous Christian community there at the hands of the occupation and extremist settlers.
Yes, so the way that we see it as Palestinians is Palestine operates as a community, and that's regardless of religion. But what I've seen personally living there is that Palestinians, Christians, Muslims, they face oppression on a daily basis, and it's the same oppression. The Christians don't get spoken about enough, which I think is tactical, but they go through the same land grabs, settler violence on a daily basis, streets they're not allowed to walk down just because they're Palestinian, regardless of their religion, facing the IOF on a daily basis, their children also getting imprisoned and arrested for false trumped-up charges, apart from the fact that, you know, Palestinians in the West Bank also get killed quite frequently, regardless, again, of religion. The Zionists can't tell what religion you are by looking at you, and so, therefore, the Christians are persecuted the same way as any other Palestinian, hence why we say that we're a community made up of different religions. It's a lack of freedom of movement for the Christian Palestinians and Muslim Palestinians. It's a lack of religious right to practice your religion, whether going to churches or mosques. It's the same persecution that they face. I think the issue that we have is that the Christians don't get spoken about a lot because of the fact that it goes against Israel's agenda of making this a Muslim Jewish issue, where actually it's a Palestinian against Israel issue, regardless, again, of religion. So, like I said, we are one community and we act in that way. And the Palestinian Christians and Muslims go through the same thing.
It's definitely something that we've seen, the unity between the Christians and the Palestinians, you know, on footage that has gone viral, but also in cases like Shireen Abu Akleh, who, you know, is one of our most beloved and treasured heroines of the Palestinian liberation, doing her job and obviously attacking attacked in cold blood and murdered by the entity. But also something that you said that was really striking to me is I found myself surprised to hear of, although I've seen it, and as a Palestinian I've grown up seeing it, I was still surprised to hear just how much repression the Christian community is suffering. And that's upsetting. It's almost like this, you know, internalized colonization that I'm fighting. Reverend, if I can come to you for this question, as a religious leader, I'm sure that you have seen and heard these things that we've just spoken about, what Amira has attested to. But you know, we know that scholars of all Abrahamic faiths have long been the targets of pro-apartheid lobbies who have launched heavy campaigns to have them displaced from their roles if they speak about Palestine. Can you tell us about why religious leaders are targets? And if you have any experience in this matter, set the scene for us.
Well, Israel is an apartheid state. It's based on supremacism. It's a racist endeavor. And it's a settler colonial enterprise. And that's an indefensible political position. And therefore, it must make its critics, particularly those committed to human rights, it must make them appear worse to distract attention from its own crimes. So it accuses Jewish anti-Zionists, for example, as Jew haters. And it accuses non-Jews like me and others as either Holocaust deniers or anti-Semites. The way they have achieved this is by pushing a misdefinition of anti-Semitism. It's called the IHRA, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance misdefinition. It's a working definition. It was never intended to be used in legal terms. But it essentially dilutes anti-Semitism from prejudice, hostility, racism towards Jews because they're Jews, but equates similar criticisms of Israel as anti-Semitism, which is entirely fallacious. It's untrue. But by imposing this new definition on particularly Western governments, churches, trade unions, universities, they have broadened out this definition. So if you criticize Israel, they'll accuse you of being anti-Semitic. In my own personal experience, I've faced 20 years or more of intimidation, where they target was critical of you, accusing you of associating with anti-Semites or Holocaust deniers and so on. One occasion they accused me of seeking to divert church funds to Hamas in Gaza, which is entirely untrue. But they intimidate you, and if that doesn't work, they intimidate others to try and isolate you. So invitations to speak in universities or churches suddenly will be withdrawn because pressure has been put upon them not to have you speak. I encountered a complaint that was made about me in 2012, accusing me of anti-Semitism. That was resolved amicably, but then they had another go in 2018, and that led to a tribunal. It took 4 years. They couldn't find a single person to come and be a witness against me. I had 50 witnesses on my side, rabbis, academics, bishops. They couldn't find a single word of mine that was deemed anti-Semitic, and yet the tribunal found me guilty of conduct unbecoming, gave me a 12-year suspension from being an Anglican priest, so much so that one Jewish academic, Jeff Halper, called it an inquisition, and the expert witness on anti-Semitism at my tribunal, Anthony Lerman, said it's an indelible stain on the Church of England to accuse someone who's never uttered a single word against the Jews to be accused of anti-Semitism. So that's how they do it. They target academics, they target politicians like Jeremy Corbyn and clergy. And if they get one scalp, one head, everyone else keeps their heads down. And that's part of their agenda, to silence criticism where really criticism needs to be directed at them.
What an interesting story, and something that I'm sure many other religious leaders have similar stories like yourself. What I'd like to do now is have us all take a look at some examples of how Christians and their beliefs are denigrated by the Zionist Jewish occupiers of Palestine.
The genocide against the Palestinian people has brought Judaism and Jewish extremism into the spotlight.
In the
From extremist rabbis calling for Christians to be killed.
2 billion Christians, which are idol worshippers, between Chinese, Indian, Hindus, Buddhists, and Christian, at least 6.5 billion people are idol worshippers that, according to the Torah, do not have the right to live. Idol worshipper, goy, it's death penalty. Not only Jews. Even a goy who bow down to an idol, who believe in JC, deserve death penalty.
In my country.
To ordinary Israelis making the same murderous threats.
Are you Jewish? Do you want to honor God? That is the godly thing to do. We respect one another.
The godly thing to do is to kill you.
The godly thing is to kill me.
That's right. That's what the Torah says.
The Torah says to kill us.
The Torah says that people who worship idols such as yourself, when there is a Sanhedrin,
to kill us.
Yes.
Okay.
That's what the Torah says.
So we know how the Jewish people feel about Christians, yes? That you discriminate against Christians.
Christians are idol worshippers.
You discriminate against Christians.
The Torah says that Christianity is idol worship.
You also have the same rabbis making threats to destroy churches.
Even if the United States government would say, okay, hey, you're becoming too fanatic, the government, too religious, we'll give you $1 billion extra every year to the aid, don't touch the churches. We're not allowed to listen to them. God comes before Obama and his friends.
While it appears that for the Jewish extremist squatters in Palestine, spitting on Christians is a favored pastime. Then there is the outright blasphemy against Jesus and his pure mother.
Reverend, if I can come to you again for this question, you know, what you've, the persecution that you've faced, I'm assuming, you know, is a parallel that you can draw between yourself, the Christian Palestinians, but also Jesus as well faced similar persecution by the people of his time. Can you give us some information on that and draw some parallels for us?
I'd be pleased to. The parallels are quite significant. The first century Judaism was under foreign military occupation, the Roman Empire, and the political and religious leaders, people like Herod, king, and the Pharisees and Sadducees, the religious leaders, were cooperating with the Roman government and oppressing the people. They were used as a means of oppressing and taxing the people. And so the parallels with Zionism today, with supremacism, with antagonism toward the poor, the marginalized, and the foreigners, the parallels are clear. Jesus was a threat to that. Even before he was born, his mother, Mary, when she was told that she was expecting him, it's called Mary's Song. She speaks about how he will bring down the rulers from their thrones. He will lift up the humble. He will fill the hungry with good things and send the rich away empty. After Jesus was born, King Herod recognized there was a threat when the Magi from Iran visited Bethlehem to worship Jesus and give him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Herod instituted a pogrom to try and have Jesus murdered as a baby. He had orders given to kill all the boys in Bethlehem under the age of 2 because he saw Jesus as a threat. As an adult, Jesus' very first sermon given in Nazareth speaks of how he would proclaim freedom for prisoners, recovery of sight to the blind, set the oppressed free, and proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. The year of the Lord's favor was the Jubilee, the time when slaves would be freed, when debts would be canceled, and that was what he was coming to do, to bring a revolution to the status quo. He anticipated persecution in his Sermon on the Mount, probably his most famous sermon. He says, you'll be blessed if you are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, falsely say all kinds of evil against you. Rejoice and be glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets. As we follow through the life of Jesus as an adult, we see him challenging the religious leaders, challenging the status quo, the foreign rulers, turning the tables in the temple, casting out those who were exploiting the poor. And on one occasion, they tried to trap Jesus, and they said, should we pay taxes to Caesar? And Jesus said, show me a coin. And they gave him a coin, and he said, whose image is on the coin? And they all shouted out, Caesar's. He said, well, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and render to God the things that are God's. He was pointing out that they were using this money, therefore they were already compromising with the government, the Roman government. Yes, pay your taxes, but remember your responsibility is ultimate to God, and he is sovereign. At his trial, Pilate challenged Jesus and said, don't you realize I can have you killed? And Jesus said, you would have no authority were it not given you from God himself. God is sovereign. God is in control. All through the life of Jesus, we see how he antagonized and challenged those who were committed to a supremacism, committed to the status quo, using their power to exploit particularly the vulnerable.
And everything that you've just said about, Jesus, may peace and blessings be upon him, and his, his fight and his resilience in fighting his oppressors is actually something that we've all seen of the Palestinians currently, whether it be Christian, Muslim, or even our Jewish Palestinian community fighting the IOF and, you know, doing so with so much dignity and so much honor. Amira, if I can come back to you, footage that we've, seen of Christians in Palestine being insulted and being spat on, etc., by the community, it's gone viral. It's not new. Yet they are, as a community, Israel kind of, what it does is that it propagates itself as this... the only democracy in the Middle East where everyone has their freedoms, whether it be in the religious sector or in the personal sector. What do settlers and their patrons in the Israeli regime really think about Christians, from your own experience, from what you've seen?
To sum it up, I think an unwanted nuisance, because if it, again, goes against their agenda, having Christians in Palestine, where they want to, make it very obvious that it's a Muslim problem, and having the Christians there is an issue, which is one of the reasons why systematically they've been pushed out, whether that be in Jerusalem or West Bank, and the population is dwindling. So if we look at, for example, in 1922, there was 10% population, a Christian population in the whole of the land, whereas now it's estimated 2% in the whole of the land. And these people aren't running away from their Palestinian brothers and sisters, but regardless of religion. They're running away from being systematically attacked by the settlers, by the regime in general, whether that's persecution, whether that's, not allowing them to practice their religion, and constantly taking from them. Whether it, their lands, their homes, they face the same things on a daily basis as the Muslims. So I think how they see, how settlers and the regime sees them is a population in Palestine that needs to go. It needs to be pushed into Jordan. It needs to be pushed into other surrounding countries, because that fits their agenda. And we've seen it. We've seen their percentage. I mean, they weren't too many to begin with, and we have to remember these are the most ancient Christians in the world that we have in Palestine, and they need to be respected and looked after, because at the moment they are facing a real threat of extinction.
Absolutely.
And if we don't look after them and show the Western world what's happening to them, in the next 20, 30 years, we face the fact that there might not be any ancient Christians that are related to the past biblical stories on the land that Jesus was born in.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's definitely something that the Muslim community in Palestine feel very strong about. It's, there has been conversations back and forth of, if our mosques are bombed, Christian priests have said that we will make the call for Adhan, and we will be the ones to honour Islamic prayer for the community. And the same, and the inverse is true, whereas the Muslims have said, if no churches exist, that, we will make sure to honour the traditions of Christianity and the land. Reverend, thank you so much for joining us. And the same for you, Amira. This is such an enlightened conversation, and I wish that we had more time to continue it. But unfortunately, that is all that we have time for today. Thank you at home, and join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
A UN official has recently warned that if the Zionist regime does not allow fuel into Gaza, immediately trucks will be stuck at the southern Rafah crossing, unable to distribute anything at all. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry, the Zionist regime committed 13 massacres against Palestinians recently. The Palestinian death toll has risen to 23,706 since October 7th, with more than 60,000 injured, the ministry reported recently. Thousands more are still missing or buried under the rubble. All internet and telephone systems have been destroyed by the Zionist regime attacks, plunging Gaza into a communications blackout once again, according to the service provider Platel. Meanwhile, the head of Human Rights Watch stated that the Zionist regime must abide by the International Court of Justice ruling, which will likely be announced at the end of this month. Tirana Hassan told Reuters, if Israel does not comply with the measures or orders of the court, then it is up to the international community to ensure that they are leveraging whatever pressure that they can to encourage Israel to actually implement the measures. The group released its World Report, which documents global human rights violations over the past year. Hassan said that Human Rights Watch was able to document the Zionist regime's crime of starvation as a means of warfare on the people of Gaza. Hassan told Reuters, in the throes of this war, what we have seen is consistent, flagrant violations of international humanitarian law. The Zionist regime is methodically blocking aid convoys headed for hospitals in northern Gaza, or slowing them down using lengthy inspections, according to the United Nations aid agencies. Andrea Di Domenico, head of the UN's local office for the coordination of humanitarian affairs, asserted recently that the Israelis have systematically or quasi-systematically refused to allow the aid trucks through. He explained that Israel had only partially approved 3 out of 21 aid missions requested by his agency. He said, in particular, they have been very systematic in not allowing us to support hospitals, which is something that is reaching a level of inhumanity that for me is beyond comprehension. Recently, all aid trucks will be stuck at the southern Rafah crossing, and no humanitarian aid will be distributed across Gaza, Domenico warned. He said, we will simply be unable to unload the trucks. We don't have the fuel for the forklift and we do not have the fuel for the trucks that are distributing the assistance out to where the people in need are. Auni Khattab, the director of the Palestine Red Crescent Society's Ambulance Center, was released recently after more than 50 days in the Zionist regime's detention. The Medical Association posted video of Khattab's emotional reunion with his family members and colleagues. Khattab had been abducted by Israeli troops on November 22nd with several other colleagues while he was transferring injured patients from Ashifa Hospital in Gaza City to the southern Gaza Strip. Mohammed Abu Salmia, the head of Ashifa Hospital, has still not been released from the Zionist regime's detention, along with approximately 100 other healthcare workers. Recently, PRCS held funerals for four of its paramedic team members killed in a targeted Israeli airstrike on their ambulance in Deir al-Balah in the central Gaza Strip. Two patients inside the ambulance were also killed. The paramedics were martyred while wearing the Red Crescent emblem, which is supposed to be protected according to international law, PRCS stated, adding, our colleagues were intentionally targeted while inside an ambulance clearly marked with the Red Crescent emblem. The United Nations Human Rights Office stated recently that it is deeply concerned that Israeli forces have placed civilian lives at serious risk by ordering residents from various parts of Middle Gaza to relocate to Deir al-Balah while continuing to conduct airstrikes on the city. The United Nations added that four separate strikes on Deir al-Balah since the beginning of January have killed more than 40 Palestinians. The agency said it is clear, as the UN has repeatedly stressed, that there is no safe place in Gaza. The United Nations noted that the recent Israeli regime airstrikes and sniper attacks on Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah, the only partially functioning hospital in the central Gaza Strip, has led many medical staff to take the difficult decision to evacuate the hospital despite the high need for medical care resulting from the continuing strikes. Recently, the hospital lost power as a result of a lack of fuel, putting patients, including infants, in incubators at extreme risk. Martin Griffiths, UN humanitarian chief, stated recently that the health sector in Gaza is being slowly chalked off as hospitals continue to come under fire. Doctors from charity group Medical Aid for Palestinians, who have been working at Al-Aqsa Hospital, told British Broadcasting Corporation recently that hundreds of patients are still being treated inside the hospital daily, but with decreasing numbers of staff available to treat the wounded and infirm. Many of the patients are arriving with horrific traumatic injuries, according to an emergency doctor. One of the physicians, Deborah Harrington, said there was little to no pain relief medication available while treating injured patients. She told the British Corporation, I can't get out of my mind. A child came in alive, literally burnt to the bone. Their hands were contracting. Their face was just like coal, and they were alive and talking, and we had no morphine. I won't be able to wipe that memory and the smell being treated on the floor. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza announced recently that the bed occupancy rate in all hospitals is more than 340% across departments and intensive care units. According to the Electronic Intifada, the Zionist regime has killed more than 100 journalists and media workers in Gaza since October 7th. Recently, an Israeli regime drone strike assassinated journalist Hamza al-Dahduh, the son of Wael Dahduh, Al Jazeera's Arabic language bureau chief in Gaza. Wael al-Dahduh's wife and two children were killed in an Israeli airstrike in late October, and his cameraman Samer Abu Daqa was killed in a drone strike last month. Another reporter, Mustafa Thuraya, was killed in the same attack that killed Hamza. They were traveling together in a car to cover a story in southern Gaza. The Zionist regime's military claimed that al-Dahduh was an operative with Islamic Jihad and that Thuraya was active with Hamas. The Zionist regime's army claimed that the two journalists were traveling in a vehicle with a terror operative who was operating a drone. Six press freedom and human rights groups sent a letter to U.S. President Joe Biden demanding that his administration act immediately and decisively to promote the conditions for safe and unrestricted reporting on the hostilities in Gaza. More journalists have been killed in the first 10 weeks of the Zionist regime's attacks that have ever been killed in a single country over an entire year. The letter states, citing statistics by the Committee to Protect Journalists, one of the letter's co-authors. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime's High Court has rejected an appeal by international media outlets to allow them independent access to the Gaza Strip.
The conversation. Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week we look at Ireland and its love affair with Europe. In this post-Brexit era, how has Britain's departure from the EU affected the relationship between Old Blighty and its closest neighbours? What is the future for the north of Ireland? My next guest is a former member of the European Parliament, a former political prisoner, and current Sinn Féin politician. As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildenew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's guest is Martina Anderson. Martina is a woman well known not to mince her words on the political stage. A straight shooter, some would say. After serving 13 years as an IRA prisoner, Martina joined Sinn Féin, where she went on to become a member of the European Parliament. Martina Anderson, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
So, Martina, could you tell me about your childhood growing up in Derry?
I would describe it as a child of the Battle of the Bogside. I lived in the row of houses, which has now got the iconic wall. You're now entering Free Derry. And by the age of 7, 1969, there had been 14 unionist bombs planted, electricity stations, RTE, water installations, and there were 6 people killed. And I come from a family of 10, and my older brothers and sisters had taken to the streets for one man, one vote, for civil rights, basic houses, jobs, what people were looking for. Most modest demands, one might say, and they were beat off the streets, as we all know. And it used to be written on the walls across Derry and across the north that the IRA equaled I ran away. There was no defence. The community was crying out for people to protect us against a state that neither wanted or welcomed us. So I grew up knowing that there was something rotten at the core of where I lived. I probably didn't have much of an understanding that it obviously was beyond Derry. It's a kind of environment that as a child I grew up in, and all of that had happened before Bloody Sunday.
And Martina, you then joined the IRA yourself, and you were then captured in England. Can you tell me about your capture and your time in jail there?
I'd previously been arrested in Derry, and I was in Armagh during the second hunger strike when that started. So I got bail, and I went on the run after 10 or 11 months. I attended every funeral of the hunger strikers that had taken place in 1981. And between that period and the period of my arrest, we will remain blank. I was arrested in Scotland, along with Ella Dwyer and 3 other comrades. And we were charged, all of us were charged with conspiracy to cause explosions in England. And Pat McGee was charged separately with the Brighton bombing. So the 5 of us ended up in Brixton Prison. Ella and I were the only 2 women and 800 men. We didn't expect to be put on remand in Brixton Prison when we rocked up that day and we were shouting goodbye to the others, saying we'd see them in court. We expected to go to a women's prison in Holloway. But they said it wasn't secure enough for us, and we ended up in Brixton Prison. Brixton Prison was a nightmare for 13 months. Apart from the Category A prisoners, and I do have to differentiate, because there were people that were from other backgrounds, you know, criminal backgrounds, that were Category A prisoners there. But they were caring individuals in relation to 2 women being among 800 men. For some of the other criminal population, it was appalling behaviour. So that was for 13 months of that, and then on top of it, we were strip searched. It first of all began 1 or 2 a day, and ended up at 6 strip searches every day. So it was a very invasive sexual environment, you know, that you felt that you were held within. That both, and then as well as that, it didn't bother me as much, the body searches. You were body searched at every move you made. Ella hated to touch on her body. I think because we were used to, and it shows you how you probably do get used to going through checkpoints and whatever and being searched. But Ella found that really offensive, how they would search us. And so between the body searches and the strip searches and the sexual abuse that we endured for 13 months, it was near impossible to prepare for your trial, because you're just trying to survive mentally. We knew that if we continued to react in the manner that we were acting, then that's where it was going to lead. So we kept having to counsel ourselves, talk to ourselves, talk to each other, and take it in the chin that this was it. And we thought that was as bad as it was going to get until we were sentenced and we moved from the fire in the frying pan, because we moved from Brixton Prison into Durham Jail.
And Martina, that sexual violence that you and Ella suffered in Brixton, it was bad enough what you suffered at the hands of other prisoners, but tell us a wee bit more about the strip searches. Would that have been one or two people carrying those out? Were there ever women involved in them? Or how many people would have been involved in a strip search, and what was that like?
You were put in the middle of a room and they circled you.
How many?
Six screws. And they circled you. So when they circled you, they put you in the middle, like you were in a circus.
Six of them.
And they would take off your clothes bit by bit, and they would make comments about your body. I remember one day, I literally came off a visit. I had that experience, put on my clothes, and I got to the cell door, and they put their hand up. They says, now we're just going to strip you again, because we're now going to do this as a cell search. I literally hadn't left the room. Mm-hmm. So we knew that they were physically and mentally trying to break us. Yeah. And it wasn't easy. You know, it wasn't an easy 13 months. It was a tough 13 months. And when we got to Durham, that was our first experience when we walked in the door again, was to be strip searched. We were strip searched when we left Brixton. We're put into the back of a van. We had in contact with nobody but screws, and we come into Durham and we were stripped again. So it continued throughout.
Were other prisoners in Durham, were the other women prisoners strip searched, or was that exclusive to you and Ella?
Generally speaking, because we were what they regarded as high risk category prisoners, they subjected us to more strip searches than anyone in the jail, either in Durham or in Brixton. Even the men were not getting the same treatment as we were. So there was a sexual connotation attached to it, because it wasn't just something that they were going to apply to category of prisoners, regardless of if you were a male or female.
So just moving forward a bit, and then your eventual release, Martina, you then joined Sinn Féin. Was that an easy transition after all those years in jail?
Yeah, it was a natural transition. We had followed the political process throughout. We were sent back here, transferred to prisons in Ireland 6 weeks before the first IRA cessation. I remember Martin had telling me that this was part of what the British were trying to do to send a signal. We had historical meetings with the ANC. The South Africans came to Longkesh Prison, and we women in Armagh were brought there. We were regularly updated about the peace and political process and what was going on in negotiations. As political prisoners, I was released under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement. My husband, who I married in jail, it's another story, he had subsequently been released after me. Jack Straw tried to prevent him and two other men getting out, because they were the only prisoners that were subjected to natural life. They were never to be released. And so the natural corollary of me was to become involved in Sinn Féin. Was it to be an elected rep? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And I toiled with going back to university. Going to university, I didn't have a university experience, but in prison I studied after having... We had a whole battle in our hands to be allowed to study and whatever, but I ended up getting a first-class honours degree with an open university course. I went into jail with no academic qualifications, and I came out with a number of A-levels and O-levels, and then on to university degrees. Well, we had no notions of going down and embarking upon that road. I always had seen myself as an activist, but very much as a non-elected activist, until... Mary Nillis had stood down, and I was to replace her, and I refused to do so. I was, at that stage, my position in the All-Ireland Coordinator, I was working on that. I had been working in the Assembly, and they used to slag me and say, she thinks she's Miss All-Ireland. I loved being in that position. And so I refused to go into the Assembly, and then Mitchell McLaughlin was moved into another constituency. And they asked me four times to stand, and I was not doing it. And then Mark McGuinness came and asked me, and we all know we don't say no to Martin.
And I worked with you and served alongside you in the assembly, and you were brilliant and so hard working and so across all the detail. But I thought you really shone when you went to Europe. You were a powerhouse in Europe, and I've credited you with the reason that the Europeans knew so much about Ireland and the implications of Brexit would have. So tell us about your time as an MEP, will you?
Barbara de Bruyn stood down in 2012, unexpectedly and for personal reasons, and I had been a junior minister to Martin McGuinness, and one of the responsibilities that I had was Europe. So the party thought I knew a thing or two about Europe, and so did I. But I had no intentions of ever going to Europe, like, to be an MEP. So they asked me to take it on, and again, one thing and another, you're persuaded to do it. So I goes over to Europe, and I thought, how am I going to make this place relevant to back here? So the first, I became involved in a lot of jargon, like rapporteur and all that there. You know, it's a lead MEP that's in charge of the file. So the Tobacco Product Directive was something that I got my teeth into as one of the lead MEPs involved in that file. And it was, how do I make, I always try to develop a model, you know, how do I make Europe relevant? So I bring you to Europe and Europe to you. And it was about the amount of people that was dying from it and took on big tobacco, the big tobacco industry. They hated me. I went after them and everything that they had said and the lies that they had told about the product. If it was put in the market now, it wouldn't come on it because 50% of the people who use it die. So I did that, and I got an experience with going to Palestine the first time in 2013. And I suppose I would describe myself as a nationalist and an internationalist. And, you know, I don't think internationalism should be in any way like a buzzword or, you know, a book token. You know, I do believe it's the fire that sort of connects communities struggling for something better, you know, across the world every day in every way. Coming from our experience of conflict in Ireland and going into Palestine to the apartheid wall, demolitions, all that was taking place, and the deafening silence of the international community appalled me. And I had an opportunity in 2013 in Ramallah, there was a tranche of prisoners being released. There was 26 prisoners being released, and I stood right into the middle of the morning waiting on the prisoners to come out. I remember crying, you know, just watching their families and everybody, just, just the emotion of it. So Thatcher's Children, as I call them, the Tory party, was engaging in a conversation publicly about a referendum and pulling out of the EU. We knew that this was bigger than them claiming to just take back control. We knew that this was about our rights, our entitlements, and this was going to dismantle the Good Friday Agreement and elements of the Good Friday Agreement if this went ahead. So the referendum, there was the Remain and the Leave, and it was two sides of the same coin because it was the Conservatives fighting among themselves. And we didn't officially take part, as you know, in any of the official campaigns, but we had our own Remain campaign. And we fought that here to explain to people why it was important that we be in the EU. We couldn't have some kind of a hokey-cokey arrangement that part of Ireland was in the EU, part of Ireland would be out of the EU, that the Good Friday Agreement, strand two of the Good Friday Agreement, the All-Ireland element of it, about alignment across this island, the whole issue of the economy, the All-Ireland economy, could not operate as it had been designed to do in the Good Friday Agreement if we were out of the EU. And thankfully, in constituencies after constituencies, we won the referendum in terms of not we, Sinn Féin, the people that was involved, everyone in Remain. But we know that in Britland, they decided in England that they wanted to leave and Scotland wanted to remain. So in Europe, after the referendum, the first thing happened was the first week there was the European Council, and Enda Kenny went over to the European Council and he waxed lyrical about Scotland, how Scotland had had a referendum and how the British government had told them if they leave the UK that they wouldn't have a place in Europe, and how Europe had said that. But he was Braveheart. about Scotland and faint heart about Ireland. He never mentioned us. Now, he was a Taoiseach going into a council meeting. And MEP after MEP would come up to us and they asked us, time out of number, will there be another referendum in Scotland? Nobody was taking us on. They didn't give a fleeting glance, the British, to this. And neither did Europe, because Europe didn't understand the Good Friday Agreement.